Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see
somebody.
Produced
at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, we're going to hear part of a discussion on the drug war, fentanyl smuggling, and enforcement at the U.S.-Mexico border. But first, the Sentencing Project has released a new report entitled Locked Out 2024, 4 Million Denied Voting Rights Due to a Felony Conviction. Let's hear from one of the report's co-authors, Christopher Eugen, Ph.D., Regents Professor of Sociology at the University of Minnesota.
I'll cut to the chase. There's about 4 million people who are locked out of the ballot box this November. You can see the distribution of those folks across different categories, but it's you know, fewer than 3 in 10 are currently incarcerated. Most folks are in the community now who aren't able to vote, but it's about 1 in 59 as a voting otherwise eligible population. Nicole mentioned there's been tremendous recent change. We called out Nebraska today that moved over from the far right column that disenfranchised post-sentence into that third column. And we talked about that over the summer. I remember, Nicole, we talked about footnotes and different things that we would say about Nebraska. We finally have finality today. Mentioned New Mexico. Minnesota is another state. My home state of Minnesota finally restored the vote to people on probation and parole. The where we have had no legal progress or no dominoes have fallen with regard to people inside to people in prison. We'll discuss that more as we get farther along. I just want to say a few technical notes about the report. You'll see a lot of continuity. We try to keep things formatted in a similar way so that you can compare with previous reports. We've been doing these numbers. I noticed my first, we're largely in the 2000 election. We started doing those and then began a series of really fruitful collaborations with Nicole, with Mark Maurer, with the Sentencing Project team. We report on the state laws, the total affected, the numbers of Black Americans who are affected, as well as Latino populations in recent years. This year, though, we're adding a few things. We had a legal review by a team at King and Spalding that has been invaluable as we've kind of refined our estimates. We've added more details on our methodology. We've gotten more questions and suggestions over the years, and we've tried to be as transparent as possible with that. We've now also added some gender estimates. So if you want to know about women in your state who are disenfranchised, you can now go to a table and look at maps. And then especially we gave great attention to Mississippi and Alabama, where there are disenfranchising offenses, and we tried to get a more refined estimate. I emphasize that, you know, what we present are estimates. They're not precise counts in all cases, but we really do our best to get it right, and we hope we've made some real improvements in this report. So I'll just briefly run through, it's about 1.7% nationally who are disenfranchised, but we have three states that are over 5% of the population. They're clustered in the Southeast, Alabama, Florida, Tennessee. If we adjust these state boundaries for the population that's disenfranchised or the rate that's disenfranchised, you can see it really reshapes the nation. And so that the areas of reform, that those have shrunk in recent years. So if you know the shape of Minnesota got squeezed pretty tightly there. Maine drops off the list, off the map entirely, because there's no disenfranchisement in Maine. But states like Florida, like Tennessee, are somewhat engorged. And this is a real visual representation of the density or how heavy disenfranchisement falls in different areas. There's still egregious racial disproportionality in disenfranchisement, as there is in the criminal legal system more generally. It's about 4.5% of the Black population is disenfranchised in 2024, or about 1 in 22 adult residents. There's 5 states in which that number is over 10%. They say we're fairly cautious in our Latino estimates, in part because the data that we are working with from the Bureau of Justice Statistics is not always accurately reported, and we expect that this is an undercount. We try to say that clearly in the report, but we estimate about 500,000, at least 500,000 Latino voters would be disenfranchised because of these laws. I mentioned that we have female disenfranchisement estimates, and I know I have a lot of words on these slides. The slides should be available in the report, so I'm mindful of time because I really want to hear from other panelists more than I want to hear myself talk. But there's about 764,000 women disenfranchised by our estimates. The key take-home here is that 90% of the women who are disenfranchised are in the community. Why is that important? That it's extremely unusual internationally to disenfranchise anybody who's not incarcerated. Around the world, the fulcrum of debate is whether people in prison should be able to vote. Certainly not people who are beyond the period of sentence. But these numbers amount especially highly for women. Women live longer and they stay in that post-sentence pool for longer. And they're also more likely to be placed on probation, where there is generally a lower recidivism rate. And so those numbers, we end up with 90% in the community, which I think is an opportunity for outreach and change. Finally, I was asked by a journalist whether y'all have any good news in this report. And I said, yes, I believe we do, that about 1.8 million people have regained the vote since 2016. This is a pretty significant drop in the disenfranchised population. It's egregious that there's still 4 million left out, but that was a number very close to 6 million not very long ago. Due to legal changes that folks have fought so hard for, as well as the cooling off of some correctional populations across many states. I mentioned there's extreme racial disparities, but these two are declining to some degree. Now, as I said, 4.5% of Black voters remain disenfranchised. That number had been 7 or 8% 20 years ago. So disenfranchisement, it still results in the dilution of voting strength in communities of color, but we're trending in the right direction. Where have the restorations been? You can see a list of states by year. And now I can kind of shade Nebraska there at the top as a post-sentence state that's been restored. But the action has mainly been restoring people in the community on community supervision. So we've moved from regimes in which they disenfranchise people on probation and parole to now disenfranchising prison only, as is the case in Minnesota. And I mentioned that there's many coalitions organizing for change. I noticed the participant list. You all are here. Thank you for your hard work. This is what a slice of the coalition looked like in Minnesota. This is the Governor Walz' signing ceremony. And around the room, there are many friends of the Sentencing Project. There's the Restore the Vote Coalition. There are activists, impacted folks, and many, many leaders. And I know that Bobby Joe Champion on the floor of the Minnesota Senate referenced the 2022 report. I don't know if you heard that, Nicole, but I was very pleased to see that when they asked about the practical difficulties implementing it, he was able to say, here's how these other states have made this change. Minnesota is not being radical in making this move. So thank you all for your attention and for your work.
That was Christopher Eugen, PhD, Regents Professor of Sociology at the University of Minnesota, and one of the co-authors of Locked Out 2024, 4 million denied voting rights due to a felony conviction, a report that was released by the Sentencing Project on October 10th. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. From felony disenfranchisement and rights restoration, we turn to fentanyl smuggling and the failure of a militarized war on drugs. The Washington Office on Latin America recently hosted a group of experts in a discussion entitled Responding Effectively to the Fentanyl Overdose Crisis, Evidence from the Border and Beyond. Let's hear from one of the speakers. Sanho Tri is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of its Drug Policy Project.
I'm going to talk about various ways that we try to interdict drugs and why it doesn't make sense that the accusation that migrants are bringing drugs across the desert on their backs doesn't really hold up. Not to say that it doesn't happen in very rare occasions, but it's not how it's done. And how building a wall is not going to make any difference in any of this. So there are many ways to get drugs across the border. This is the old fence that was built pre-Trump era, but the traffickers found many countermeasures to this. The most obvious one was to build a ramp. They've been using them since Roman times, since the siege of Masada, for instance. It's very easy to build a ramp and move people as well as vehicles over it. They also tried Roman-era technology. This is a catapult or a trebuchet where they can launch big packages of drugs over the wall. And this catapult is actually bolted directly onto the wall itself. You see this string where the traffickers pull down on the string, it brings the arm down, and they place their drugs on it, and it flings it right over the wall. Then Donald Trump decided to build a wall. This was this theme from his 2016 campaign. He built a small portion of wall, but take a close look at this image. This is called a bollard wall. It's not a solid wall because you can't build a solid structure in the desert because of flash floods, sand dunes, and small migratory animals and such. But if you look closely at the back there, notice the gaps in between these bollards. It's about 4 inches wide, and it's very easy for drug traffickers to have a very simple countermeasure to this, which is simply to make the drug packages 3.5 inches wide and move literally hand unlimited amounts of drugs through the wall if they chose to do that. There are other ways. If you've been to big stadiums or sports events, you've seen T-shirt cannons where they fire T-shirts and other things into the audience. The traffickers have adapted this to a much larger scale. This uses compressed air, and it's basically an air cannon that can shoot packages of drugs over the wall. This is a much larger version built into a van, and you can see some of the drug packages being loaded onto the van, onto the cannon. Again, these bales of drugs are very large, so it's not difficult to shoot quite a bit over the wall. Next, they can also go under the wall. Tunneling technology has been around for a very long time, and these tunnels can be very sophisticated with their own electricity, rail systems, ventilation, drainage. They even have cisterns to catch the water because some of these tunnels are underneath the water table, and they're again, once you have the electric rails set up, you can move drugs around the clock, almost an unlimited amount of drugs. You're limited only by how much you can conceal in a warehouse on each side of the border and move trucks out without attracting too much suspicion. But you can see notice the size of the packages here. Again, very narrow, a little bit more narrow, and you can literally hand it through the Trump wall. This was a tunnel found in Tijuana in about 2011. They found 40 tons of marijuana on the Mexican side waiting to come through. So that gives you some sense of the scale of what they're able to move. And of course, if you move drugs north, you can easily repatriate cash south, as well as smuggle weapons and ammunition south. Then there's a sea route. These are semi-submersibles. There are many different types of so-called narco submarines. This one is designed to stay mostly underwater, but the conning tower is above the water that allows the crew to get air and to navigate. These can carry anywhere from 4 tons to 12 tons of drugs. And they're very, very sophisticated. Many of them are now crossing the Atlantic Ocean, going to Europe. But many of them are used from the western coast of Colombia and Ecuador to move drugs up to Central America. or sometimes on the Atlantic coast as well. This is a faster version of the semi-submersible. And just to give you a sense of scale, you can see how massive these things can get. And they're basically made of fiberglass or carbon fiber. And more recent years, they found actual proper submarines that were custom built for drug trafficking that can dive up to 50 feet below water. See, these are much harder to detect and much more sophisticated. And you can see the anatomy of a drug submarine and typically what goes inside one. It's not luxurious. Very often they don't even have bathrooms. There's a great blog called Covert Shores by a guy named H.I. Sutton that gets into some of these narco subs, as well as drones. Then there's also narco torpedoes. They can be either bolted directly underneath a larger freighter, for instance, so that when you go into port, unless you send divers underwater, you're not going to find these things. They can also be towed by a cable behind a vessel. And then if they're stopped at sea, they can release the cable. And the cargo, it floats away. And if there's a coded signal so that it raises a buoy that gives a coded signal for the location so that the follow-on smuggling vessel can then retrieve the package. And so the police find nothing. And then one of the mothers of invention is prohibition, but the other one is war. And out of necessity, Ukraine has, for instance, developed tremendous technologies in terms of uncrewed vessels. These are designed to carry explosives, of course, but they can easily be converted to drugs, and drug traffickers are paying attention to these things. There's the aerial route as well. So in the old days, they would find old small planes. We got better at detecting those. At one point, it became practical enough for them to buy an old airliner on its last legs and use it as a one-way smuggling mission. And then they've had smaller ones, ultralights, that can fly below the radar but above the wall, and they have drop cages underneath. And when they cross the border, and they can just pull the lever and release hundreds of pounds of drugs to their accomplice on the other side of the border. And then there's drone technology. This is the one we commonly think of, a small drone carrying small amounts of drugs. This one has crashed. But the new drones are much, much, much more powerful. This one is designed to carry 500 pounds and can fly for half an hour. China is developing a commercial drone that can carry 1 ton for about 180 miles. So from Washington, D.C. To New York, for instance. And then Donald Trump has also said that flying cars would be part of his vision for cities of the future. His tech billionaires are really plugging the idea of modern, futuristic cities with flying cars. Well, once these flying cars are commonplace, and they're already adopted in places like Dubai and other markets, they can be used to shuttle people and drugs back and forth over the wall very easily. And then coming down the line, 20-ton payload drones China is developing. And some of these are, again, the cartels are ones that can afford them. And in the future, we have these kinds of things. It's already happening, these technologies to move people and large heavy items over short distances. And again, you can see what the Ukrainians have done in terms of drones and technology. And then finally, there's the last week, Reuters put out a very good investigation of drugs and how they're smuggled. The precursor chemicals for fentanyl, they found that, I used to think that they were smuggled into ports in Mexico to manufacture the fentanyl there. But in fact, much of it is coming into the United States first in small packages that are duty-free. So when you buy these small things from Temu and other places, it's easy to smuggle. And then they go into airplanes and they pass through customs without much inspection. And then they are smuggled to Mexico because we don't really inspect cargo going southbound. So for all those reasons, this is why it doesn't make sense to try to stop drugs at the border.
That was Sanho Tri, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of its Drug Policy Project, speaking on a panel hosted by the Washington Office on Latin America entitled Responding Effectively to the Fentanyl Overdose Crisis, Evidence from the Border and Beyond. Let's hear from another of the speakers. Sarah Mehta is a senior policy counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union.
Just building on what Sanho has already shared, this latest round of the war on drugs risks making some of the very same errors, as previous iterations, you know, doubling down on punitive and expensive models of interdiction and deterrence, but failing to address the real public health and treatment needs in our communities. I know my colleague Militsa is going to share more on effective solutions, so I want to talk about the damaging policy linkage between fentanyl trafficking and migration and the harm to American border communities when it's only enforcement-only approaches that are pursued. At this point, we know that numerous reports, including a very recent one from the U.S. Sentencing Commission, have shown that fentanyl trafficking is not tied to immigration. Over 80% of individuals associated with a fentanyl seizure in the United States are U.S. citizens. Only 0.02% of those arrested by Border Patrol for crossing without authorization had any fentanyl whatsoever on them. But most federal policies and proposals to address fentanyl trafficking continue to focus on border enforcement, coupling drug interdiction with expansive border policing, surveillance, and enforcement that hurts not only arriving immigrants and asylum seekers, but also our border community residents. Along both the northern and southern border, our ACLU offices have repeatedly found that roving patrols ostensibly looking for drug traffickers have engaged in rampant racial profiling of U.S. citizens, lawful residents, and other border community residents. And this expansive border policing has now been exacerbated by increasingly xenophobic border policies at the state level that, again, are fusing drug enforcement with anti-immigrant policing. A case in point is Governor Abbott's multi-billion-dollar Operation Lone Star, a border security operation that has expanded to counties well beyond the southern border, and that pretends to target drug trafficking, human smuggling, and through trespass charges, unauthorized immigration. Everyone is probably now very familiar with the more abusive actions that this operation took against asylum seekers, particularly last summer, including young children. But as a law enforcement program, in reality, again, the majority of those arrested are U.S. citizens in our border communities. What we have found at the ACLU, and particularly the ACLU of Texas, in research published earlier this year, is that these arrests are disproportionately impacting Latina and Black U.S. citizens. There have been repeated due process violations in the hearings that they get, and the arrests that are related with this very abusive program. At the same time, while ostensibly looking for drug traffickers, officers in Operation Lone Star have been responsible for very dangerous car crashes, resulting in close to 200 injuries in the past couple of years, and at least 75 deaths, the most recent taking place just last week in El Paso. Border residents are living under multiple layers of state and federal policing, as well as surveillance from aerial surveillance towers and drones, interior checkpoints, roving patrols, and other technology deployed within 100 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border. But this policing does nothing to address the real needs of those communities, particularly access to health and real treatment. The Rio Grande Valley in Texas, for example, is one of the poorest regions in the U.S., with some of the worst health indicators in the country and rising substance abuse rates. But they are flooded with border policing and not treatment resources. This is not a sustainable or healthy way to be protecting our communities. Our work across the United States has shown repeatedly that policies that focus on arrests and prosecutions for drug use and trafficking consistently hurt communities of color and still fail to deter drug use. Instead, they do deter treatment. Research has honestly repeatedly shown that the most common reason people give for not calling emergency services during an overdose is that fear of prosecution and police involvement. Now, just a final cautionary tale on expanding border technology to identify drugs. First, as Asano already noted, the drug packages will just continue to get smaller and harder to detect, probably at a rate much faster than the technology can accommodate. At the same time, much of the technology used by Border Patrol to deter drug trafficking and unauthorized migration, again, these aerial surveillance towers, drones, you know, other examples exist too, they cover huge swaths of the interior of the United States with very little oversight on their expansion and their use. Just at the southwest border alone, there are 19 million people who live in that border zone and are subject to this growing and incessant surveillance. At the ACLU, our most recent report on checkpoints and abortion access also shows that, you know, we've been trying to recommend very strict limits on the use, collection, and retention of data that is pulled in by that sweeping border technology deployed, again, 100 miles from the U.S. international border. And at ports of entry, meanwhile, the federal government has repeatedly experimented with highly invasive and exploratory technologies, things like facial recognition, justified in the name of border security, that has then expanded well into the interior of the United States, raising very significant privacy and civil liberties concerns, just like drones, for example, which started with CBP along the border and have now been employed routinely by police within the interior of the United States. Before giving yet another massive influx of funds to CBP for border policing and surveillance, without considering its effectiveness or the costs borne by Americans living in these border communities, without critical oversight and accountability, we need to invest in policies and solutions that actually address the very serious problems of fentanyl and other drug-related deaths. Our communities are not made safer by heightened policing and militarization, and they deserve the long overdue investment in public health and community-based resources.
That was Sarah Mehta, Senior Policy Counsel at the ACLU. Now, here's Maritza Perez Medina, Director of Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance.
Criminalization of drugs and drug use actually drives people deeper into isolation and problematic drug use. And that's because it instills fear and stigma. People will do what they can to avoid that, including avoiding jail and prison time. This means that people are less likely to call for help in situations of overdose. This is why it's really important that we resist calls to further criminalize fentanyl or other synthetic drugs, and generally drugs, right? We also know that incarcerated settings are rife with drugs and that overdose deaths are actually also increasing there. And it makes sense. I mean, these are places where there's inadequate access to health services, inadequate access to medication for opioid use disorder. We know that upon leaving an incarcerated setting, people are 27 times more likely to experience an overdose due to lack of support and systems of care in prison walls and outside of prison walls. So again, rather than investing in these failed supply-side interdiction and criminalization approaches, it's more than past time that we actually invest in evidence-based public health solutions that get at the demand. Rather than wasting these resources on this perpetual game of whack-a-mole, our country really must start to focus on addressing demand, which ultimately will help save lives. And there are a few bills that I wanted to bring to your attention. In my day-to-day work, I engage with the U.S. Congress and the federal government on policy solutions. And it's really important to name that there are some really good bills out there that really do take a public health approach to drug activity, including the Stop Fentanyl Overdoses Act. This is H.R. 3375 and S. 1785. This bill really scales up treatment services and health services in this country to address problematic drug use. There's also the Reentry Act, H.R. 2400 and S. 1165. This bill would make it so that individuals can have access to medication for opioid use disorder while they're incarcerated by ensuring that they're covered, that their health care is covered.
That was Maritza Perez Medina, Director of Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance, speaking on a panel discussion hosted by the Washington Office on Latin America entitled Responding Effectively to the Fentanyl Overdose Crisis, Evidence from the Border and Beyond. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!